Today, we're talking with Jackie Summers. He's the founder of Jack from Brooklyn and the creator of Sorrel Liqueurs, which is the most highly awarded liqueur in the U.S. He's a James Beard finalist, an extraordinary writer, and the first licensed black distiller in the United States. Jackie had a lot to share with us about his journey, from following your interests and what you love, to building community based on your values. I hope you'll find something here to support you on your journey as Jackie shares what he'd tell himself from where he is today. Welcome to I'd Tell Myself, where we dive into the individual journeys people have taken to professional success and share some of the lessons that they've learned along the way. I'm your host, Danielle Frankel. I've long believed that there are many ways to learn the important lessons in life. And while some lessons are only gained through personal experience, others can be learned less painfully from those ahead of us on their own journey. I hope you'll find something here to support you as we ask these individuals what they'd tell themselves from where they now sit. Welcome, and thanks for joining us.
Hey.
Hey there.
How you doing?
I'm all right. I'm so glad that you joined me today. I'm really grateful. For our listeners, do you want to just a couple fast facts? Tell us your name, what you do, who you are, so people know who's talking. They're used to me by now.
My name is Jackie Summers. I am the founder of a company called Jack from Brooklyn and the creator of Sorrel Liqueur, which is the most awarded liqueur in the country by far. I am America's first licensed legal black distiller, and I am also a prolific writer. I'm a James Beard finalist, and I do a bunch of other stuff for the community.
So that's quite the list of credentials and accomplishments.
I mean, kind of some of that stuff. It's a bigger picture historically than it is about me. Like, it's a lot of that stuff isn't really about me. And being the first legal licensed black distiller, that's so much more about the systemic barriers that are in place for marginalized people than anything special about me. Having the most awarded liqueur on the planet, listen, I'll take credit for having perfected a recipe in my kitchen, but that beverage has been around for thousands of years. I didn't invent it. I put it on the market in a shelf-stable form. So a lot of this stuff isn't really about me. It's true that I'm an award-winning writer, but the stories I've written, I mean, that was about my family. So yeah, the accolades sound interesting, but I always feel like you have to put things into perspective.
I appreciate that, and I appreciate the perspective. You know, the coach in me wants to ask if you see yourself as the channel for all those things. And I mean, imagine carrying the mantle of being the first licensed black distiller, whether it is something that you think about every day or not, whether it's something that you attribute to yourself, right? There's got to be a weight that comes with being the first anything.
Well, there's two things I'll say about being the first, and then I'll answer the statement. There's only two purposes to being first. Number one is to make sure you're not last. And number two is to make sure that the path for those who come after you is easier. And I say that to say, I was in Detroit a couple of weeks ago at a place called the Motown Legacy Lounge. It's brand new downtown Detroit. And their claim to fame is they only have Black-owned spirits. It may be the first bar in America that is 100% Black. And they have over 100. And I'm sitting there at the bar with the proprietor, a gentleman named Lazar Favors. And it dawns on me, I'm looking at his 100-plus Black-owned spirits, and Sorrel is the eldest of them all.
Oh, wow.
Sorrel has been on the market. So in many ways, it's not a direct line, but it is a predecessor of all of the spirits that are on the market today. And what that feels like, it feels laden with responsibility. Because again, the story isn't about me. I can only do what I do because I stand on the sacrifices of my parents and my grandparents and my great-grandparents. And it's just my job to make sure the mountain is higher when I'm again, part of the story, to make sure the people that come after me, like, they can stand on my sacrifice the same way I stand on those who came before.
I mean, on a personal level, I'll say that deeply resonates with me, and I feel that.
in so many meaningful ways. But I'm also going to say, you know, that's a choice, right? It is a choice to come into the world in that way with what you're doing. It is a conscious choice to be and show up, to show up in the space the way that you are. There are plenty of people who I'm sure, given the opportunity in some way to get to some modicum of the success that you've achieved, right? That wouldn't be their priority. I mean, which might mean that they wouldn't have made it to this point, right? You are unique in who you are, and that is what has allowed you to get to where you are.
It isn't really a choice for me. I will say that it is more intentional now than it was previously, but it's a joke I tell people at this point. My ownership of a liquor brand is incidental. I'm a community organizer. That's really who I am. And Sorrel and the other brands that I will create are a vehicle for storytelling. And it only works as part of a community. One of the problems I find with many entrepreneurs, especially marginalized people, is they've got it burned into the brain that they've got to go do everything by themselves. And historically, that's not how indigenous communities flourish. We flourish together. You cannot accomplish alone what's done in community. So I want to contribute to my community in a meaningful way. That's the most important part of what I can contribute to the story.
That's amazing. Yeah, that perspective is, I find that to be a really grounding perspective. But I want to take a step back because there are a lot of places to go forward with that. But part of the purpose of this conversation is to actually understand part of how you got to where you are today. So as a storyteller and a business owner and a, you know, intentional or otherwise leader first in many ways in across industries, I have to start with when you were a kid. Like, are these the kinds of, you know, community organizer, storyteller, business creator? Are these the kinds of things that you wanted to be doing? Did you have a vision for what you wanted to do when you grew up, when you were little Jack?
I mean, yes. And those visions were created by somebody who clearly didn't have the breadth of mental capacity to know what the hell he should do when he grew up. I think it's kind of awful to sort of put kids on this, what are you going to be when you grow up when you're 5 years old? You don't have the faculties to decide what you're going to be when you grow up. There are predilections. There were patterns in my life that are easily detectable and traceable from the time I was young. Loved food, loved flavor, loved science, loved learning, loved design. There are a whole bunch of things over the course of 40 or so years that I did just because it was something I loved doing that are super useful now that I run a business, but they weren't actually things that I intended. It was literally just, here's something that's interesting to me. So I'm going to go find out how to be really good at this thing because I like it. And son of a gun, all that stuff's useful now. So it wasn't intentional before the intent was to do what felt good to my soul. And now all those things that felt good to my soul contribute to my being able to be a good businessman.
That's great. That is exactly the point, actually. That's not why I started this story gathering exercise, right? People follow what they love. They take unusual paths. They do things that you can't know are going to add up to X, Y, and Z in the end. But then you get to a certain point and there's a sort of exponential recipe in the cauldron. And that's where the magic is.
I'm a trained illustrator. I went to school for graphic design. So my branding is actually done by a guy named Chris Wright. Today's his birthday. I've known him for 40 years. We used to sit at the lunch table together in school. And he is by far a better designer than I'll ever be. So I can see very clearly what is good design, but I can't execute it myself. But having had that foundation background, it actually really contributes to our overall branding, which means even though I'm not personally doing it, I know when it's right.
Yeah, all the pieces come, you can help see all the pieces come together. You know where it works. That's great. So you studied graphic design. Is that right?
I've done a bunch of things. 5 years on Wall Street, 10 years advertising, 10 years publishing. I was an underwear model for a while. I'm a professional songwriter, producer. I've done stuff. Again, life is short and you should do the stuff that you're supposed to do, and trying to figure that out when you're a kid mean, it might not be reasonable. I've changed careers several times. And I still juggle multiple careers. I run the liquor business. I'm a professional public speaker, and I'm a published writer. And I got a couple of books on the way. Can't talk about that today. But yeah, all of it sort of comes to a head in this liquor business, doesn't it?
The way that you're using it, it does.
Yeah, but the way that I'm using it is in line with, you know, again, deeper purpose. Everyone, any good businessman can make money. Like a good entrepreneur makes a difference. There's an opportunity here to tell stories instead of just make money. And stories will remain long after the money is spent.
An impact, right?
Again, the story was here before me. It's just my job to make sure the story goes on after me. I, for reasons that aren't mine to discern, am the custodian of this story for this generation. And it's what's beautiful about it is seeing how other people are coming together to help me tell the story. My chief food scientist is a guy named Dr. Hobie Wedler, PhD chemist, sommelier, born blind. The joke Hobie tells is he says he can see flavor. The joke I tell is I say he's like Daredevil, but with booze. And his contribution to this recipe I perfected in my kitchen has been dynamic. Since he came on board, the product is less expensive to make. It tastes better. It's got better shelf life. It's got better stability. It's got better color. And he's a genius marketer who is an absolute powerhouse in the conversation about the rights of disabled people. I love working with him because the story is bigger with him. Tiffany Barrier, the drinking coach out of Atlanta, is one of the most visible Black bartenders in the country. But more than being a bartender per excellence, she is the keeper of the cultural pathways of our stories. No one, I think, in our industry understands more than her how all of these things came to be, not just the liquors across the board categorically, but the drinking culture. And now she's telling parts of the story that, again, I don't know. So again, my role ultimately as a community organizer is to take these stories and not just to wrap it around myself, but to allow the story to breathe and to expand through other people who can contribute to it in ways that I couldn't.
Community organizing it at every level, wherever you go, huh?
Ultimately, yeah, I am a believer that we are better together than we are apart. And we have more that connects us than separates us. And I'll tell you right now, Danielle, I've been in thousands of bars and restaurants. I've been in dozens of states and hundreds of cities. And if there's one thing I've come to believe beyond the shadow of a doubt, it's that people need to get up off their asses and go drink at a different bar. Go drink at a different bar. I have drank with all sorts of people around this country, most of whom don't share my personal reflections on society. But you drink with somebody and you listen to them and they listen to you. And maybe you don't solve the world's problems, but you walk away with a little better understanding of somebody that you didn't really know before. We should all switch drinking buddies. It's hard to hate your drinking buddies.
That's great advice. I still want to go down that road. But before I do that, I want to circle back to a number of things that you've said actually already. So you've lived several lives, it sounds like. You've run a number of careers already in very different areas. And I don't think we're actually going to have time to dive into all of the different pieces of those. So let me ask you a slightly different question.
Better buried.
Okay, so we'll leave some of that buried then, that's fine. But they are so different, right? Wall Street, graphic design, writing, being an entrepreneur, standing up businesses. Each one of those things is a potentially huge life-altering change, right? It's a new path to follow. And you mentioned earlier, you should do what you love because you don't know how long you're going to be here, right? I'm curious sort of is there a pattern or a call that you picked up, or what is it that allowed you to sort of take those big chances and make those big changes and do it effectively over and over again?
There are two answers to that. The first answer is, my mom raised us to be curious. I was taught to read by the time I was 3, had no library card by the time I was 4, entered first grade, reading on a 12th grade level. I would go to the library every day, come home with stacks of books, read them all, bring them back. And if there was something I didn't understand, my mom would say, look it up. She wanted us not just to know, but to be curious. So that has been super helpful all along the way. But as far as an impetus for change goes, I had a miracle happen in 2010. I had a cancer scare. My doctor found a tumor inside my spine, the size of a golf ball. He said, you have a 95% chance of death and a 50% chance of paralysis. If you live, you should organize your paperwork. I lived. This would be an awkward conversation if I died.
It would be very difficult, but also fascinating on a whole different level.
Right. But the experience will adjust your perspective. I had 25 years at that point invested in corporate America. I was solidly in my 40s, and I left all of that. I left a well-paying job in an industry that I really was established in to do something I'd never done with no money and no contacts so that I could pursue what was then my dream of day drinking professionally. All I really want to do is spend time with interesting people in the middle of the day, in the middle of the week. I want to have great conversations over great food and beverage, and I wanted to monetize it. And when I couldn't think who was going to pay me to enjoy that lifestyle, I said to myself, and know what I'll do? I'll launch a liquor brand. I didn't think if it was difficult. I'm sort of broken in that I don't know what I can't do. I didn't think I don't have money. I didn't think I'm not a food scientist. I didn't think I don't know anyone in this industry. I thought I'm going to do this. And it was, again, because it was something I really wanted to do. There wasn't, just like the drawing and just like the music and just like the writing, you have to figure out what you want to do. I tell this to people all the time, and some get it and some don't. You have to know your why. When you run out of reasons to do the what, if your why isn't strong enough, you will stop. My why was I didn't want to be in an office anymore. I wanted to be around people and grow my life. And I couldn't do that in a cubicle. So I left. And the rest is interesting.
The rest is interesting. And here we are. So you followed the why, and mostly because you wanted to hang out with people and enjoy life.
Yeah.
And
I mean, how cool is what we're doing right now? It's a Wednesday afternoon. This is awesome.
Yeah, no, this is terrific. I love this. Doing this podcast has been the best. So you left corporate America. Thank goodness you survived your, sounds like a terrifying cancer scare, at least to me. And you, is that the point at which you launched Sorrel?
So they pulled the tumor out of my spine in the summer of 2010. And I remember knowing that I just couldn't go back to work because I'd changed. And I'll never forget walking into the office two weeks after I had my spinal cord outside my body. I'm going into the office and I'm ready to resign because I just want to live a different life. I have no idea what I want to do yet. And before I could open my mouth, before I could open my fat gap, they offered me a package. I signed as quickly as I could, cleaned out my desk. I walked to the first bar with a box of my stuff at 11 o'clock on a Tuesday morning and started texting my friends, suddenly unemployed, come drink. And from about noon that day till about 9 o'clock that night, folks wandered in and out and just to hang out for a few minutes and say hi. And all I could think to myself was, why don't I do this every single day? So there were a couple of problems with launching a liquor brand. Turns out it's harder than it sounds. The first was I had to, not being a food scientist, solve the problem of how to make the beverage shelf stable. Shared version is 623 failures in my kitchen. Tons of experiments poured down the drain, notebooks full of notes, hundreds, literally, of tiny tweaks to get it right. Version 624 is a recipe that we bottled today, except instead of 2 gallons at a time, it's now 1,000 gallons at a time. Problem number two was I didn't have any money. So I taught myself how to write a business plan. Problem number one was solving the problem of making it into a product, which took a long time, but done. Problem two was having no money. So I taught myself how to write a business plan. I went to all my friends who had MBAs and I asked them, how do you write a business plan? And none of them had ever done it in real life. They just done it for school. So I taught myself, as I taught myself how to make a stable beverage, as I taught myself all the other stuff in my life. I didn't know anybody. I had no contacts. So for the first year, it was me doing cold calls. I would literally wake up in the morning. I live in Brooklyn, throw a dart at a map, pick a zip code, and then type in liquor stores in that zip code and walk to every single one of those stores. And I would walk in and go, hi, I live in Brooklyn. I make this stuff. And people inevitably would say, oh, delivery is in the back, because no one had ever seen a Black liquor brand owner before.
I'm sure that led to a lot of really fun conversations for you.
Oh, there will be a book at some point. I have stories for days. Stories for days. But again, all of my stories are in service to the bigger story. All of them.
So how did you get a position in the front door? Everybody kept trying to send you around to the back, assuming that you were delivering instead of...
I have a very simple rule. Never accept no from someone who's not qualified to say yes. There's lots of people who can usually say no. There's usually only one person who can say yes. And if you're not that person, you're wasting my time. You're a no person. Point me to the person who you're going to ask permission to say yes. And let me have a real conversation with someone who can make some damn decisions right here. Get out of my way.
Great. Love it. Okay. So you find the decision makers who can actually say yes. And they said?
And Sorrel takes off. It takes off in a way that was not unexpected by me, but required real change in order to actually make it into a product into a successful business. It did well enough. By 2015, to have attracted national attention. I signed a deal worth millions of dollars to take the brand national, and that company reneged on the deal. 2016, I signed a second deal after months of a very competitive negotiation with another liquor giant for millions of dollars to take the brand national, and they reneged. And the super short version of that is I had a nervous breakdown and ended up homeless for a year and a half. 2017, I was homeless. Wow. I have this very distinct memory of December 2017, waking up to the sensation of snowflakes melting on my face. And that sounds idyllic, except I live in New York. I woke up outside in New York City in winter. And my first thought was not, I should get somewhere warm. My first thought was, I need to charge my phone because I have an essay due and I'm saving money to get an apartment by writing, and I have a deadline today. And if I miss my deadline, I will not have money to make my deposit for my apartment.
Wow. Your story is fascinating. I could dig into all of the different aspects of your story. You're an amazing storyteller. You have lived so many adventures in ways that most people are too scared to attempt. And I get that you don't necessarily give credit for that. You don't give yourself credit for that specifically, but I think that you are who you are in part because you make those choices and because you're willing to take on those adventures. And then you very generously are able to turn those things around and share those stories in ways that are meaningful to other human beings.
Nothing gives people permission to be themselves more than you being yourself. So the sharing is, again, me trying to contribute in my own limited way to community. Everyone should feel like it's okay to be who they are. Unless you're an asshole, then please learn to do better.
I love that you're giving people room to do better. And it's not just don't be, but do better. Do better. Everybody can do better.
With the effort. Try.
Try. Drink with somebody new. See what you can learn.
Drink with somebody new.
Yeah.
And you don't have to like everything that they say. You get to hold your opinions, but be curious. Be curious.
Yeah. Yeah. So you woke up in December with snowflakes on your face, and your first thought, living in New York City, so sleeping outside, not ideal, let's just say. Fair?
I'm literally trying to write my way out of homelessness. And I have an essay due that day. And if I miss my deadline, I won't have money to get an apartment.
But what happened if we go back a second, right? Because you talked about these two amazing deals that you set up for your business, both of which fell through and understandably had a huge impact on your mental health and well-being.
It also meant I had no source of income. Zero. Most businesses cannot survive without monthly income. I went a year and a half. I went 2 years with zero money coming in. And I think most people in this country sort of underestimate just how close any of us are to homelessness. Most people, 3 months of no income, would be out on the street.
And in New York, especially.
And in New York, especially.
Wow. So you made it 2 years, just about, right? But when those deals fell through, that couldn't go any further.
Yeah. Yeah. And the truth of the matter is, that's part of the story, and I have to honor it. There are, in all great narrative acts, the call to action, and then there's the fall from grace. And in that period at the second act, it's imperative that the protagonist learns the thing that they were supposed to know from the beginning, and it changes them. And you return to the cause a changed person. And you can pick up where you left off, but you're not the same. And that is very much the arc that I found myself in. I started off with what I thought was this great idea, which was to day drink. And it started off really exciting. I'm meeting people. I'm doing this thing that I said I was going to do. And then the entire bottom fell out. And it makes you question everything. And that is a unique gift. I got to question everything. What I found out was that it was never about me. It was never about me. It was always about, this is a story that is bigger than you. This is a story that predates you by centuries. You must take your role in telling this story as its curator, as its narrator for this generation. It's the only way the story moves forward. And when I was willing to step into that, when I was willing to combine both the part of me that is a community organizer and the part of me that was a brand owner, that's when everything changed. So in service to the story, yeah. The narrative goes on. And at that point, everything changed. The brand is back on the market as of 2021. We are in 37 states with another 12 states launching this calendar year. We won 75 gold or better awards in international spirits competition last year alone on a single SKU. And I have to say gold or better because we won gold, double gold, platinum, double platinum, triple platinum, diamond, best of class, best of category, best of show, chairman's trophy. I won a proof of point. Inarguably, I made one of the best liqueurs, not just in the country, but on the planet, in my kitchen. And now my challenge is twofold. My challenge is to figure out how to take one of the best liqueurs on the planet and turn it into one of the best selling liqueurs on the planet, because the more it sells, the more stories get told. And it is always in service to the story.
Version 624.
Yeah, exactly.
So how do you use the sales of this incredible product that you created to tell the story? And what is there a specific story that you want to travel with this, or that you feel that you are responsible for shepherding with this?
There are many different aspects to the story and many angles from which it could be told. But for me, what is important is the aspect of cultural identity. Hibiscus flowers were used in Africa for thousands of years for medicinal purposes. Antioxidants, antimicrobials, antifungal. It's an anti-inflammatory. It's a natural aphrodisiac. You want to get knocked up? Have some hibiscus tea every day. This becomes part of culture and tradition. It's why almost the entire Afro-Caribbean diaspora has an almost epigenetic memory of something that we think of as the red drink. Flash forward to around 500 years ago, and the transatlantic trade starts. And now bodies and spices are being stolen from the continent of Africa, shoved into the bottom of boats, and sold in ports of trade in the Caribbean. And when I tell you that they did everything they could to strip these humans of their identity, they kidnapped them, they broke up families, they beat them, they raped them. They forced him to serve a different god and speak a different religion. They changed their names. They tried to erase everything about who they were. And somehow, because that flower that grew in hibiscus, that flower hibiscus that grew in West Africa would also grow in the Caribbean, because it's also located in that narrow equator band, because that flower can literally grow in the soil that they were planted in, from where they were stolen from, that drink continues. It defies any effort to erase identity. This becomes how people from Africa, from the Caribbean, remember who they are. It becomes part of the cultural identity. For centuries, there are no recipes because the people who are making it aren't allowed to read or write. If you didn't watch your grandma or grandpa make this, this gets lost to history. So for all of the parts of the culture that were squelched into non-existence over the course of slavery and colonization, for some reason, this singular cultural identifier remains. It is a mark of joy. It is a mark of resilience. And it is an opportunity for me to willingly accept the responsibility of speaking for generations who couldn't speak for themselves. It's not about me. And it's truthfully better. If someone in 150 years from now wants to talk about me, that's fine. But right now, it's only my job to contribute to the story.
How fortunate for the ancestors to have such a fabulous storyteller to carry it forward.
I mean, sort of. It's kind of, I completely accept the idea that the ancestors picked me for this for reasons I won't understand until I'm one of them. But yeah, they will run haphazard with your life. none of this was planned, and now I get to be intentional about it. But a little warning might have been nice.
I mean, maybe they sent one and you missed it.
That's a possibility too.
I don't know what those warnings would look like. So I have no advice in that department. Oh man. What an incredible story to be able to shepherd, to bring forward, to carry out.
Here's the beauty of it. The beauty of it, and where I see all of this leading, is Sorella is one of how many untold stories? You can go all across the globe, and I intend to, and find people who, for whatever reason, have been marginalized, that have a cultural identifier that's part of their story.
As we were talking about the story that you get to shepherd and, you know, the fact that I'm clearly of the belief, right, wrong, or indifferent, I should be less I should be unbiased, but I'm clearly of the belief that there is a reason that you're a shepherd for this, right? That the combination of your curiosity and your disinterest in factors like whether or not you had the cash in the bank or knew the people, and your ability to share the story, to see the story and share the story, right, is why it's you. You know, I guess yes. You don't want it to be about you. And so I'm not saying that it has to be about you as the person, but, you know, those are factors that, absent any of the special pieces of who you be in the universe and how you show up and the things that you have cultivated because you have love and interest that you are willing to follow, right? You are uniquely positioned and capable for the work that you are now, that you now say you're in service of.
So I'm a practicing Taoist, and one of the fundamental tenets underneath Taoism is the belief that we are just temporary manifestations of the infinite divine. But as much as that is a spiritual belief, we know scientifically energy can't be created or destroyed. We have observed the actual spark of electricity that happens at the moment of conception. And if those cells divide and become a human being, that person will accumulate experience unique unto themselves for however long it lives. And then when that person ceases to be alive, that spark goes away. And I was holding both my mother's and my father's hands when they died. And one second, there's a body that's generating electricity and heat and BTUs. And the other second, there's not. Where did it go? Because energy can't be destroyed. So my reasoning is, if the universe is not giving to waste, and it's not going to waste the energy that was my ancestors, then why would it waste the petabytes of information that was their lived experience? Because that's the only thing human beings can contribute to the infinite, is their own personal lived experience. So yeah, collectively, the ancestors that existed before me, the reason I'm here, have done whatever they could to shape my life in a particular way that I could be useful for them. I'm here to make sure this story gets told. I'm here to make sure people know my mother and my father, Wilda, who we've recorded this on what is the anniversary of my mom's death. And it's important to me that people know that Wilda Jean, Billy, if she liked you, taught me everything I need to know about cooking. And that Dighton Merrick, her father, taught her everything she needed because he was a trained chef. It's important to me that I be a part of telling the stories of the people who are responsible for why I'm here. And I'm convinced that in their afterlife, whatever that is, they have consorted and decided to shape my existence so that I can be a living tool for this. And that's all good. That's all good.
That's awesome. Like you said, it's all good. It's, you know, it's awesome clarity about what you're here and what you're doing and why.
If you don't understand your why, you will eventually stop.
So if I can, again, circle back just a little bit in the story, because we've talked a bit about some of your, you know, different career experiences, and we talked about how you have built this brand a bit, but you are also, as we've said several times, an incredible storyteller. And you touched on the fact that, yeah, at one point you were literally working your way out of homelessness through your writing works. Do you want to share a little bit about how that piece of the puzzle has emerged for you or shaped you, or how that shows up in your universe?
I like telling stories of marginalized people from their own unfiltered words. And it means I get to explore, largely through food culture, what shaped what we eat and drink, and the challenges that the people who've carried those traditions face today. It's a great honor to be able to talk to chefs and mixologists and bartenders and restaurant owners about what their pathways have been because there is a collective sense of the obstacles that they've had to face. And again, these people are doing these things in isolated incidents by themselves, they're spread across the country. But in community, we can just do so much more together. And I love having an opportunity to not just connect the dots, but connect the human beings behind the stories. It's fun, but more than fun, it adds reason behind everything I do.
How did you get into doing it professionally?
How did I get into writing professionally?
Yeah.
Oh, I had my heart broken in 2008 so bad I forgot how to breathe. I had my heart broken so hard, I thought I was literally going to die from sadness. And in order to try to mitigate the pain, I started writing. It turns out that writing about pain doesn't mitigate it. You get to describe your pain in exquisite ways, and your pleasure, that make other people either feel bad or good, but it doesn't actually make you feel different about your pain. It did help to hone my skills as a writer. So again, when we talk about the stuff that's useful for me today, it's not surprising if I'm going to admit ancestral influence in my life, that something needed to sort of kickstart that aspect of my reality. And what I do now would be very different if I wasn't a professional writer and public speaker, because I get to have a voice. There are only two ways in this industry to get a distributor to care about selling your product. The first way is to show up with a little dump truck full of money. And that might get you interest for one market, for one state, for 1 month. The other is to make yourself relevant and impactful. And I have tried to make myself relevant and impactful in my community in a way that my distributor actually cares about my story. In 2018, I was invited to ADI to give a talk. And I gave a talk to a room full of distillers. And the talk was called "Nobody Wants to Drink Your Shit." And I told 150 distillers, listen, you got your DSP? Congratulations. You put your juice in a bottle, the TDB approved, your label, it's sitting on someone's shelf, nobody cares. You think you're in the liquor business, but you're not. As of right now, you are in the relationship business. And if you can't contribute to start and maintain good relationships, you could have the best juice on earth. If you're an asshole, nobody wants to drink your shit. And having skill as a writer and public speaker and being part of a community has allowed me to create the kind of relationships where, although I don't have a dump truck full of money, I can get people to care about the stories. And through the stories, we sell the product, and through the product, we tell more stories. It's a virtuous cycle.
I'm sure they were super happy to hear that speech from you. I bet you
it was well received. I tend to not pull punches. I don't find that anyone is served with buttery words.
Yeah. So I want to just build a couple of bridges, if we can, in the journey that you've had to where you are now, right? I mean, can you share with us maybe something from your Wall Street or underwear model days? We didn't even touch on those, or some of your other career, various career pathways, right? Things that you learned in those spaces that unexpectedly have served you where you are now.
I mean, it all comes together. I remember being on Wall Street in the early 90s and learning about valuations of companies. And the thing that they teach you is, it's not a question if your glass is half full or half empty. The question is, what happens if your glass breaks? And that's a valuable lesson that applies in many different ways. People will argue over the half full, half glass empty thing, but you have a glass. At some point, your glass is going to break. And you're arguing if it's half full or half empty, fill your glass. You can refill it again. It's a glass.
Especially useful guidance, given that you sell liquor. That's important.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah. Handful of questions that I love to ask all of the guests that come through here, right? Given where you are now, is there an unexpected kindness that someone has shown you along the way professionally that's shaped who you've become or how you do things today?
In 2012, a woman named Summer Lee walked into a liquor store where I was conducting a sample tasting of Sorel. It was a holiday season. There weren't a lot of people in the store. She walked in, she bought a bottle of Prosecco and was walking out the door, and she turned around and saw me sitting there, and she'll never admit this, but she gave Sorel what I call a pity taste. She felt bad for me. She tasted it. She made a funny face. She asked a couple of questions. She took a bottle and a business card and left. What I didn't know and what I couldn't have known is that she went to a party after that with a bottle of Prosecco in one hand and this bottle of Sorel, which she just tried a few minutes earlier, in the other, got to the party and watched people pass the bottle of Sorel around. It was finished in 20 minutes. They didn't. Okay. They didn't drink the Prosecco, but she watched this, and she gets home 1 o'clock in the morning and she sends an email. Just wanted to let you know, Sorel was a big hit at the party. I do wine sales. If you'd like some help, let me know. I write her right back because at this point I'm literally doing everything myself. We didn't get to touch on this, but I'm making it. I'm hand delivering it. I'm doing the books. I'm doing the social media. I'm doing the marketing. I'm hand pouring bottles of Sorel, a hand filling them with a lemonade pitcher, because at the time I don't even have a filler. But I write her back. So glad that you liked it. Now look for help right now. Stay in touch. And she did. Once a month I get an email from her. Hey, here's my resume. Hey, here's a CV. Hey, here's a letter of recommendation. By the fourth month, I was like, you know what? Yes, I could use some help. But because I've been burned before, we need to vet you. So here's what we're going to do. I've got 4 tastings this weekend. Take one of them. I'll give you product. I'll give you POS. If you do well and you have a good time, we'll talk about it later on. She goes to this tasting. She sells 16 bottles of Sorel in 2 hours. She sells out the store. So I say to her, this was good, but this was a control because we need to make sure this wasn't a fluke. We need something to measure this against. Please take another tasting. And if you do well and if you enjoy it, we'll talk. Second tasting she takes on her own, she sells 18 bottles in 2 hours. She sells at the store again. So she starts working for me part-time. Summer Lee has her full-time job, and in her spare time, she's hitting 20 accounts a day in behalf of Sorel. I see my account base start to rise. After 3 months, she says to me, I want to quit my wine sales job and work for you full-time. And I sit her down and I say, you have to know I'm an unreasonable person. You have to understand this before you sign on. And I make her say it out loud. What she doesn't know, and what I didn't tell her till years later, is I just started paying myself. And I stopped paying myself so I could bring her on board. She's talked with me as a full-time salesperson and goes from full-time sales to New York regional manager to general manager. And then in 2016, I pulled her aside and I said, listen, I'm creating the position of VP. And I'd like to offer it to you. She goes, no. And I go, okay, but I'm creating the position. And if you're interested, it's going to be open. She says nothing for 3 weeks. And then finally, after 3 weeks, she says to me, after 3 weeks, she finally says to me, what does a VP do? And I tell her, you got 3 jobs as VP. Number one, you are the guardian of our story. You make sure our story is told our way in our markets. Number two, I need your unfiltered opinion on stuff. You are advocating the right to say things, to agree with me, to make me feel better. If we agree, great. But whatever you think, I need to hear it straight as you can give it. And last but not least, I can be a bit much. And you're one of the few people who's demonstrated you can actually check me sometimes. So when someone needs to yank my chain, yank my chain. Summer Lee is my VP to this day. And she is a person I trust with my entire company to make sure that not just things are done in a particular way, but they're done how we would do them. She understands the spirit and the motivation and the guidance behind everything that we're trying to accomplish. She can do everything I can do, backwards and in heels, but she was smart enough not to launch her own company. We talk about a kindness done. Somebody really walked into a Lego store in 2013 and changed my life and the direction of my company. And I'm grateful to her every single day.
Wow. That is powerful. I'm going to put her on my list and have a conversation with her next.
She is fun. And I will go on record and say she is the best number two in all of craft spirits, hands down. There's not a more ethical human being in the whole damn industry than Summer Lee.
Wow. That's amazing. How amazing to have somebody like that to work with you every day, to try that level of trust and support. I mean, it's life-changing. Clearly.
Can I tell you a fun story that's usually off the record?
Please. Yes, always.
2016. I am again in negotiations with this company for millions of dollars who want to take an interest in Sorrel. Me, my lawyer, billionaire liquor mogul, his lawyer. And we've agreed on pretty much all of the points of negotiation, except for one thing. They're giving me pushback on Summer's salary. And I'm immovable. Finally, the lawyer says to me, well, what does she do? Again, me, my lawyer, billionaire, his lawyer. And I look the lawyer in the face and I say, Summer keeps me from killing everyone. And yes, then they make the nervous laugh. And the lawyer says, well, how often does that happen? Just to clarify here, I understand how distribution got started in this country. And I understand that sometimes you must speak to people in a language they understand. So I say, I mean, I'm joking in my heart, but I say with the straightest possible face, I say, sir, I have a distillery in Red Hook, Brooklyn. I've got PVC piping, floor drains, 55-gallon drums, and access to industrial solvents. Things happen. And his response was, and how much does she make? Which was the right answer.
Oh my gosh. I got nothing. I got nothing on that story. That's, wow. I'm glad that it all worked out for Summer and you. And the distillery is hopefully, you know, still body free.
Although I joke, and it really is a joke about how being a distiller would be a perfect cover for being an assassin, I no longer make Sorrel myself. It is now made at Laird's, America's oldest distiller. They are 10 generations deep and 300 years strong. They were making liquor before this country was a country. Their license number is 1. And they're doing a better job of it than I ever did. So again, grateful for Laird's contribution to the story, not just for their skill and for their acumen, but for their qualities. They understand legacy and integrity. I wouldn't have anybody else work on my products.
It's so obvious to see how your personal values drive the business that you're running, but also how amazingly that reflects in the people that you work with.
Valuations are bullshit. Values are real.
Oh, good. You gave me a social media quote. I can meme that. Thank you. Perfect. Gosh, it's like, know exactly what you're doing here.
It is a story I tell very often. Any investor knows that you can show your 3-year projections. Fine. If you launched a business in 2019, your 3-year projections were bullshit. You had no idea that everything was about to tank worldwide. But your values, that's the stuff that guides you when you have nothing left. They can take everything from you. You have to give away your integrity. I can make more money. I cannot make more integrity.
Do you have a t-shirt that says that?
No, I don't.
Okay. Well, we'll see. We'll see if we can fix that for you. That's awesome. No, I mean, you know, on a serious note, obviously, I wholeheartedly agree. You know, the work that I do is around leadership development and manager training. And at the core of all of that is the personal development work that every human being needs to do, and that you've pointed to over and over in the story that you've shared with us, right? In the ways that you understand your own values and that you live those values in the relationships that you build with other people, in the way that you expect as a standard that others who engage with the work that you're doing will do that. I mean, it sounds to me like it is a core of the community that you look to develop, right? Is that you connect with people on that values level. Not that you are unwilling to hear others, but that the people with whom you are truly building are people who connect at that values level with integrity.
I'm going to go on record and say that I agree with Mitt Romney when he says corporations are people, in that corporations are an expression of the majority shareholders' opinions and choice to move through the world. My values are expressed through my company. So the day that the Roe decision came down, we made a public statement. We unequivocally support a woman's right to bodily autonomy. Is it controversial? I can't see how that's a controversial statement. Did we lose some people? Sure. Did we stand up for what we believed in? Absolutely. After all of the transphobia that hit the country, brands were particularly quiet last year around Pride Month. We made it a point to go out and say gay. Say it. Because if you don't stand up for your values when they're put to test, you don't have values. You have a marketing campaign. You have slogans.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I have nothing to add to that. I agree. It does raise an interesting question, though, and one that I do try to ask most of our guests as they come through, given that y'all are all in positions where you tend to oversee other people in the work that you do, right? I mean, I think your approach to leadership is pretty well illustrated through these stories, I think. But I'm curious how you learned to manage work, how you learned to, you know, I know you said you approach everything with curiosity. You've worked across so many different industries, but so few people get training or opportunities for actual development that is not throwing you in the deep end and allowing you to sort of scorch the whole pool dry in the process if you mess it up. So what's that experience been like for you?
Again, I'm going to point here to my spiritual beliefs. I'm a practicing Taoist, and almost all of my managerial leadership strategy can be tied to Tao 17. The best leader is one who you don't even know is there. The second under that is someone who's loved. Second under that is someone who's tolerated. Under that are leaders who are despised. Having people hate and fear you is not a good path for leadership. The best path for leadership is exactly what I attempt to do with how I run my company. I have what I call the 95% rule. And what it means is 95% of the time, I have no idea what my team is doing. And I don't want to know. It's my job to establish the parameters, to create the boundaries, and to set the objectives. And then it's my job to find the people who have the abilities that I lack and truthfully things I don't want to do, who are better at me at actually articulating those goals, whether it's sales, marketing, whether it's social media, P&L sheets, and then it's my job to get the hell out of their way. And I only get involved after everything is done if someone needs me, and most of the time they don't. They know what they're doing. Like, why would they need my interference along the way? If someone needs me to sign a check, sure. If someone needs me to adjust somebody, absolutely. But the whole point of hiring a team is trusting them. If you don't trust your team, why would they trust you?
It's a good philosophy. Hire the right people and get out of their way.
Yeah.
It's so interesting to me in these conversations, because the ways in which people have come to understand themselves and understand how to work best with others, essentially, right? Again, as unique as everybody's individual journey throughout their careers. But it's fascinating to me to hear once somebody gets to sort of a certain point, and obviously there is definitely some bias in this, given that I'm choosing the guests for the show, right? But the overlap in what those perspectives look like. I mean, I think at least half of the of all of the people that I've spoken with have voiced a similar perspective ultimately that they've developed in how they work with their teams. It's not, for many of them, not what they started with, right? It's taken a long time to develop, a lot of mistakes. They watched a lot of other people make mistakes. They were the recipients of a lot of those mistakes, right? But ultimately, I think at least half of the guests that we've had on so far have come up with a very similar approach. And it's just really neat to see.
Listen, I will tell you that every single member of my team is better at their jobs than I am at mine. I have a team full of lions. There's not a single follower on my team. There are no soldiers. They're all generals. They're all leaders. So that means I have to figure out how to stay in front of them. Otherwise, why would they follow me?
So what are you doing out front these days?
I sit on the Vibe Advisory Council. And for those who don't know, the Vibe Advisory Council is a conglomerate of all of the top on-premise restaurant brands across the country. So it's the people who are in charge of alcoholic beverage for Applebee's and for Denny's and for TGI Fridays and all of the giant, truly giant restaurant chains in the country. And they asked me to sit in on their conversation, be part of the board, because they felt it was time to have conversations about race and discrimination. And I have gotten that call more than once. It's why Tales of the Cocktail called me. It's why Bar Convent called me. It's why James Beard called me. When you want to have difficult conversations, yeah, that's when my phone rings. So what I am engaged in doing is I am engaged behind the scenes of shaping not just the narrative, but the educational curriculums of how we talk about things like racism and sexism and homophobia and Islamophobia and anti-Semitism. Under my watch, Tales of the Cocktail had their first ever all-Black panel and their first ever all-queer panel and their first ever all-Latin panel and their first ever all-women panel. We had their first panel on pronouns. We have made it a point in the 3 years that I was a co-chair for the Tales of Cocktail, we made it a point to highlight the voices of the marginalized to the point where that's part of the expected curriculum at this point. I was the first person to have a disabled person as part of my conversation on discrimination. And what's really funny about that, I'll never forget this, yesterday was his birthday. Yannick Benjamin is a disabled sommelier and restaurateur, and he is a genius. And he's one of the kindest people I've ever met. Again, master sommelier, he's in a wheelchair. And he was part of my panel in 2018 about this conversation about discrimination. And we get to the venue to present this seminar, and there's no ramp for the disabled person. He was fine with us having to pick him up and physically put him on stage. I was livid because they proved my point. I was asked to speak in a seminar in 2020 on discrimination. And someone asked me, like, what do you need? And I said, do you have an ASL interpreter? And the response I got was, well, we don't get a lot of deaf people on our seminars. And I was like, yeah, but causation or correlation? Because maybe if you had an ASL interpreter, they would attend.
Certainly and be helpful.
I reshaping the narrative and helping up and creating a space for others to contribute to the conversation is, I think, how I am best serving my community at this point. If we don't create these spaces, no one's going to create them for us.
And so you become an advocate for far more than just yourself and far more than the ancestor story that you now carry, huh?
But there's no way to isolate yourself out of this. I had someone accuse me a while back of not focusing on Black issues and having too many points of intersection in my conversation. And my response to that was, there are gay people that are Black. And there are women that are Black. And there are trans people that are Black. And there are Jews that are Black. And there are Islam. There are Muslims that are Black. There are disabled people that are Black. There are Black people that are some combination of all those things. How am I supposed to not speak up for all of those things if Blackness can be encompassed in any one of them? If it's not intersectional, you're wasting my time.
It's a bar. It's a bar to set.
It shouldn't be a high bar to say, not individuals, but the system in which we inhabit, which we didn't create, was designed to advantage some to the disadvantage of others. And if you want to continue to exist in this system, it's incumbent on us to figure out the parts of it that don't work and replace it with things that do. It is very much the ship of Perseus. The structure remains the same. But as we grow as a society, we can and should figure out how to make this ship better so that it actually serves us as we move forward. A ship that was built 200 years ago wouldn't be expected to contribute to a battle today. But for some reason, we're trying to take the same framework that was used more than a quarter of a thousand years ago and have that work for us? No, we're supposed to continue to shape and mold and change this thing so that it serves all of us the best way, because the only way we get to go forward is together. The only way forward is together.
I agree. And I love the analogy of the ship. Thank you so much for joining me today. This has been really wonderful. Jackie, thank you so much. I do have one other invitation for you, which is that I know that today is the anniversary of your mom's passing. And is there anything that you would like to share about her with us?
I will share my mom's toast with you and the audience. My mom taught me a toast that apparently has been in our family for generations. Her mom gave it to her, and so on and so forth. It's call and response. One person says, may you live forever. And the other person says, may you never die. Daniel, I gave that toast for decades, not understanding it, because everybody dies. Nobody lives forever. And then I started working on this project and it finally clicked. This isn't about how long you inhabit a fleshly body on earth. This is about living a life that is worth telling stories about for generations. In the same way I tell the stories of my ancestors, I want people that are living right now to realize you are future ancestors and you should live a life that they'll talk about for generations. Danielle, may you live forever.
May you never die.
Never die.
Thank you so much, Jackie.
Thank you, Danielle.
That's it for today. I hope you enjoyed the show and found something to support you wherever you are on your own journey. Don't forget to subscribe where you listen to your podcasts and head over to idtellmyself.com to sign up for updates. Until next time, take care.